All right, on today's episode, we interview Josh Abramson. Some of you know Josh as the founder of College Humor, Vimeo, or Busted Tees, brands that many of us are familiar with, and really a wealth of information. So on today's episode, we talked about what you start with may not be the same thing you finish with and how to diversify in a business journey. In addition to that, we also talked about how to leverage things available to you in your journey to help avoid boiling the ocean and taking on too much risk. And last but not least, we talked about what it looks like to sell to a $1 billion company, how to mitigate risk, and some of the challenges that he faced in that journey. Casey, tons of information. What were some of your big takeaways?
Multiple exits. He was a startup guy. He got a chance to do his own acquisition and he was able to get a really big exit. Very humble, solid gentleman. I was very impressed.
Awesome. So excited about this one. So let's hop right in. Welcome to the M&A Launchpad podcast with your host, Casey and Ferris with Equity Launchpad. On this podcast, you will gain insights on acquiring, investing in, and selling profitable businesses in the lower to middle market. Whether you're a business owner, investor, or aspiring entrepreneur, at Equity Launchpad, we will provide you with the knowledge, guidance, and capital to navigate the world of mergers and acquisitions. And on today's show, we have Josh Abramson. He's an American entrepreneur and co-founder of the comedy website College Humor, which I grew up on. He was one of the principal owners and founders of Connected Ventures, whose properties also include Vimeo, Busted Tees, and the co-founder, owner, and CEO of the crowdsourced t-shirt design company TeePublic. Josh, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you, Josh.
Yeah, I know. I'm excited to have you on. Like I said, I've heard your story a few times, so it's exciting to kind of have you participate on the show and really learn a little bit more about the mechanics of what happens, right? Everybody sees websites, everybody interacts with things, but most people don't realize the proof of the pudding and kind of what it takes to make the sausage. And so, you know, with that said, I guess wanted to hear a little bit about how'd you get started?
Yeah, so I got started in 1999. I was a freshman in college. I went to school in Virginia. My best friend from high school and I, you know, we did some like entrepreneurial stuff when we were in high school, but, you know, super small level, like, you know, we would DJ the school dance and that sort of stuff, just trying to figure out ways to make money that were a little bit unorthodox. So when we got to college, we were kind of, you know, shooting around ideas for ways to start a business. Had the idea to start a website that was, you know, advertising based and, you know, saw some of these businesses that were, you know, becoming popular in that point in time. And we were kind of, you know, going back and forth on like, what would that be? Like, how do we get people to come to a website so that we can then put ads on the website and make money? So we had a couple of bad ideas. And then one of the things that was unique about starting college in 1999 was that most people didn't have high-speed internet before they got to college at that point in time. And then they got to college and all of a sudden you have a brand new computer, you have high-speed internet and you're surrounded by, you know, tons of people. So it was a really interesting moment for the internet and for, you know, young people who were sort of just becoming like avid web users. So, you know, this was obviously many years before Facebook and YouTube and websites like that. So the way that people were sharing funny videos and pictures and that sort of thing was really peer to peer. You know, people would have their computer signed up to the
MSN Messenger and you'd send the thing off.
That. So that was really the idea, was let's take all of the stuff that's kind of floating around the dorm rooms, like quite literally, and just put it on a website and then direct people to that website and see if we could make it grow. And that was how College Humor was born. And that was, again, late 1999. It was sort of, you know, crazy for us at the time because it really grew quickly. And it was, you know, from like idea to like getting big checks every month was like, you know, 3 months. And that just felt insane. So,
well, let me pause you there really quick. I got to ask you a question because, you know, I went to college in 2005, so I'm a few years behind you, but again, same generation, grew up from basically no phones to phones, from, you know, dial up to DSL. And similar to you, I was an internet entrepreneur at the time. I had my, we had a few different companies, and the one thing, and I still remember pre-YouTube, right? Because I actually looked at building something similar to YouTube, and I remember scraping College Humor once upon a time and built my own database of all of the same stuff. What gave you the confidence around the server hosting costs? Because that was always, you know, to me at the time, and I was still kind of young and naive, and it was really expensive to host that kind of content. And so especially 1999, I was looking at it 2002, 2003, where even then I didn't think the economics worked. And so what gave you that confidence, so, and what, you know, how did that work back then? This is a little bit of internet lore for those people on the show.
Yeah, I mean, so what was unique about that moment in time is it was pre.com bubble burst. So there were ad networks that would host your website for free. So, you know, there was one called Blah Blah, for example, that went under, you know, probably by the time you started college, but in 99, they were going strong. And you would literally just put your website on their hosting platform. And then they would put banner ads on the top and bottom, and you would make, you know, a couple dollars CPM for as many page views as you could possibly generate. And nobody was really super sophisticated in terms of, you know, conversion, you know, tracking and that sort of thing. So we were incentivized to just get as many page views as possible. And the more page views we got, the bigger check we got at the end of the month. So it kind of seemed like almost too easy. And it was, obviously that model did not continue to exist for too long. But we started right at the perfect moment for that, because we started to get traction and started to build confidence in the business before the bubble bursts. And by the time it did, we'd already made a little bit of money. And that was actually, you know, when I think of when I started to really come into my own as an entrepreneur and like really understanding how, you know, people on the internet sort of, you know, how you can actually make money on a website, that really came in 2001 after the bubble had burst. And then those deals were no longer there, both from, you know, the advertising deals were not there and the free hosting wasn't there. So we actually had to pay for our own hosting. We had to figure out how to sell ads. And that's when it got really hard, but that was also when it got exciting. And that was what led me to start to understand, you know, how do you take an audience and send that traffic towards a website to get them to actually buy something and take a percentage of that, or, you know, selling ads to, you know, whatever. I mean, at the time it wasn't brand ads because we didn't, you know, we hadn't cracked that nut yet, but we were doing a lot of, you know, conversion based stuff. So like selling posters, selling funny t-shirts.
I remember allposters.com. I actually made a lot of money on allposters. Like I said, I was kind of a slightly different variation of what you had done.
Yeah. So, I mean, we tried all sorts of stuff, and allposters was one of the best affiliates that we had. And then we had a couple t-shirt websites at the time that were paying us a lot of money. So that was how the idea for BustedTees.com came around, which was, you know, why don't we build our own e-commerce business and we can use the traffic from College Humor to, you know, generate revenue through that. And, you know, selling posters and making posters was harder than making t-shirts. So that's why we decided to do t-shirts. The path of least resistance was often the way in those days. So that was how, you know, we started doing e-commerce. And then for a little while, by this point, I graduated from college and was really, you know, we were just trying to build as much stuff as we could. And we were, you know, somewhat focused on College Humor, but also focused on trying to build other things. So we built a, you know, a social networking site for college kids before Facebook that didn't really work. We built.
I still remember the rollout of their strategy, right? It's all about strategy. But really quick, I guess, what was the revenue at and expenses at the time you were graduating college from College Humor?
So by the time we graduated, we were, I think at the time when we graduated, we basically were making the same amount as like a really high paying job out of college. So I actually can't remember exactly what our revenue was, but I remember like when we decided we were going to do it full time, we knew that we would be able to make, call it like $60,000 a year. So that was sort of, you know, call it like sometime during our senior year of college. And then by the time we graduated, the business had continued to grow. And then that next year it really grew. So we ended up, you know, making quite a bit more than that, but that was sort of, you know, once we got to that threshold, that gave us the confidence to like not take an actual job. But, you know, in that following year, we launched the t-shirt business, and the t-shirt business within a couple months was making us more money than the College Humor business. So then we started focusing on that. And then right around that time, we kind of finally figured out, I think the first big brand that I ever sold advertising to was Toyota, and learned pretty quickly that, you know, I can sell something to Toyota for $40,000 that I would only be able to sell for $4,000 to, you know, somebody who's focused on, you know, generating conversions. So that was when I started to really understand how brand advertising works. And then once we started to crack the nut on that and the college humor business, you know, started to overtake the t-shirt business very quickly. And that was when it started, you know, right around then we moved to New York City and then everything got really crazy very quickly.
Now, let me ask you about this, Josh. Is your family, are y'all entrepreneurs? Like, did you grow up in a family of entrepreneurs or were you like kind of the first one to get this creative just to go out and do?
My father ran companies. So he, and I guess you could call him an entrepreneur, although I don't know that he identifies that way, but he, you know, when I was really little, he owned a juice company. So they would bottle juices and it was very different from the type of business that businesses that I've had. I mean, you go in and it's like huge stainless steel tanks and warehouses and like giant freezers and refrigerators. And, you know, it was like a very, it was a factory basically. So I grew up seeing that. But you know, the sort of interesting thing to me about the internet was, you know, even as early as like, you know, when I first started selling things on eBay or just, you know, understanding that you could actually make money just sitting at your computer, there was something very appealing about that. And just the idea of having
a website. I will admit, first money I made online was selling items on Diablo 2. And I don't know what I was thinking as like a seventh grader giving some random person my home address, but I did. And the guy mailed me cash and, you know, he kept on doing it for a year. So it's definitely some crazy times. To quickly just tie it together, because you kind of unpacked a lot. So I want to make sure I understood it and the audience understood it too. So you went from really leveraging an existing platform. They did all the hosting, all the costs, and even did all the ad sales for you, right? You were just really focused on kind of the community, so to speak, or the messaging, right? You know, the product, which is called Humor. Then that went out. You had to kind of go build it up yourself. And now you're like, holy cow, there's real costs. You know, we have to figure out how to make this profitable. Right. And so then that led to just doing affiliate marketing, such as All Posters. And I guess at that same time, you had higher expenses. So then you shifted and said, hey, we're going to go build kind of this t-shirt business. Right. And mimic what All Posters did. And I am curious if All Posters was still around because they were such a monster at the time. But anyways, mimic that model in t-shirts. Right. You got a little bit of traction there. And I think it sounds like you learned and you started focusing more on that. And then you learned about selling to brands and shifted focus back onto College Humor while you're doing both simultaneously. Is that right? Did I get it all correct?
Yeah, that's pretty accurate. I mean, by the time we moved to New York City, it was July of 2004. And the next 6 months were really pretty wild because suddenly, you know, we moved to New York City. We were meeting all sorts of amazing people very quickly, people who had started companies that we, you know, read about and they wanted to meet us. And that was really fun. We'd never had that experience. And then, you know, pretty soon after that, we started to have, you know, the Viacoms and News Corps of the world reaching out and expressing interest in buying the company, which just had never even occurred to me that we'd be able to sell the College Humor business for some huge amount of money. I mean, I remember somebody, well, specifically it was Nick Denton, who, you know, was the founder of Gawker. He was telling me once that he thought our business was worth $20 million, which was like crazy. You know, if you would ask me what I thought it was worth, I would have said a tiny fraction of that. And I think he was right, but it just didn't even occur to me. You know, it's, you look back and, you know, you sort of take for granted that, you know, when you're 23, you know, a lot of these things that might seem obvious to us now are not. So, so we moved to New York and I think so much of the attention that we were getting was focused on College Humor, that it made it easier to just kind of go all in on the College Humor business. Even when, you know, later in 2004, my business partner, Jake Lodwick, invented Vimeo in our office. And, you know, it was difficult because at that point we were really focusing on College Humor and we'd had these other side projects, which were, you know, the t-shirt business was nice. We had the sort of, you know, the social networking thing was not working. So we sort of, you know, put that to the side. And then this new business Vimeo comes about. It's like, all right, well, this is cool, but we don't have unlimited resources. And I think perhaps most importantly, there was the issue of copyright infringement. And, you know, College Humor was in the business of using user-generated content to generate page views, right? And as a result of that, as you can imagine, we would occasionally get cease and desist. We got sued once or twice. That was really stressful. And, you know, when Vimeo first launched, and this was before YouTube, you know, the idea of people uploading copyrighted material in sort of a free for all, all I saw were the legal bills. And as a result, you know, put a lot of throttles on Vimeo, you know, kind of pushed for everybody to focus more on College Humor. Sure enough, you know, YouTube launches a couple months later. And for a while, we're neck and neck in terms of audience.
YouTube, I was one of your first users.
Yep. Oh, yeah.
I remember loading videos on Vimeo. No, and it just in the mortgage business. I was in the mortgage business and we were putting up content. And there was just not a lot of ways to get stuff up. And that was it. That was one of your options.
And then I remember like I had built a clone of YouTube and just, again, it goes back to the legal risks and then the hosting risks, like both of those things. And at the time it was crazy to think about building a business that can stay not profitable for so long. Right. Yep. With it. I mean, that's the problem. You have to, I was way too young to understand that. Right. And That's the whole business model for YouTube right now. Obviously it's a very profitable business, but at the time, I mean, you have to look at it. There's, you know, legal stuff are never fun. Right. And again, we're kind of, this is the important stuff that most business owners don't think about. Getting sued is very, very common. If you're in business long enough, you will get suits. And, you know, we deal with those all the time, right? Those happen for a variety of reasons. Those are always stressful. And then in addition to that, just kind of, does the business work? Does it not? Should you continue to double down or not? And, you know, in the Vimeo or the YouTubes back in 2004, 2005, I mean, it was a model that really shouldn't have made sense, right? But question for you, yeah, really quick. Tell me, what did the business look like at 2004 or 5? And what I mean by that is, like, what was the org, right? What did you have teams doing, you know, around? Is it a team focused on selling ads, a team focused on getting content, a team that's out there doing, you know, physical promotion? I mean, what did the team look like? How many people was it at the time? And what were they focused on?
So, by the time we started Vimeo, there was a period where we had College Humor, our, you know, social networking dating site. We thought social networking was more for dating at the time. So me calling it a social networking site is a little bit revisionist history, but that was sort of what it was. We were building that. We had our t-shirt business. We had started another t-shirt business that was a little bit more fashion forward. And of course, College Humor and Vimeo. And I think there were four of us doing all of that at that time. So I don't know. I had this idea, which was, you know, flawed at the time, but for whatever reason, I was very reluctant to hire people. I think I was just overly cautious. I've always been pretty conservative just with how I think about, you know, businesses and profitability and all of that type of stuff. So I think as a result of that, I really waited a long time to hire people. And then the first few people that we hired, you know, we hired an engineer that proved to be hugely impactful. We hired an editor, somebody to help us on the editorial side that was really helpful. And we hired somebody from Maxim Magazine at the time to help with branded ad sales. We figured that that was like a pretty good, competitor. So that was sort of like the core initial team. And of our business partners, you know, I had my business partner that I started the company with, Ricky Van Veen, who was really more on the editorial side and the, you know, the content and that sort of thing. Our partner, Jacob, who invented Vimeo and was a coder, he was our only engineer. And then the last partner to join, his name was Zach Klein, and he was a designer and product guy. So between the four of us, we sort of had everything kind of covered, but just not a lot of coverage. So, you know, by the time when we eventually sold the company in 2006, I think we only had about 15 people or 16 people. And I think the business
pretty lame
that year made about $3 million on $6 million in revenue. So, you know, it was small, but profitable.
And what'd y'all sell it for those listeners?
So we sold 51% for $20 million. And then
the $40 million ish valuation on the whole thing, right?
Basically. Yeah. And
basically what is that? 8X revenue?
Yeah, I mean, it was a little tricky because there was the media business that was at a higher multiple and then the commerce business, which was at a lower multiple. And I forget what those were exactly, but the, you know, it was also, you know, I would never advise anybody to sell 51% of their company, but again, we were young and a bit naive and, you know, somebody.
How old were you at this point?
I had just turned 25.
So what is that process like for 20? It sounds like your partners were around the same age.
Yes. Yep.
What's that process about thinking about selling?
I mean, you're now advice
when someone gave you, when they would give you a $20 million offer, right? What's that like?
So I had an offer to sell the business in 2000 for $9 million when we had just started, and didn't take it in part because it was unclear how much of that money we would actually get based on how it was structured. But I sort of, you know, like that was before the dot-com bubble burst, right? So I'd had that experience of sort of thinking about it a little bit. And then, you know, fast forward to when we had real companies trying to acquire us, that really started in earnest in 2005. And it's because, you know, some people from MTV networks had reached out to us and, you know, we just started having conversations and we weren't really sure what those conversations were. And then, you know, the guy in the room is, you know, gives us his business card and it's, you know, executive vice president of mergers and acquisitions. We're like, okay, well, like maybe they want to buy our company. So, we went through a super robust due diligence process with Viacom to the point where, again, just being naive and young, I was basically telling everybody I knew that I was selling my company to Viacom because I thought that it was a done deal, basically. And after spending many months on the deal, they ultimately just decided they didn't want to do it. So that was late 2005. But in the process of doing that, we brought on Allen and Company to help us with the sale. And we also, you know, went through the process with News Corporation, which didn't end up working out either. So by the end of that year, we were kind of like, you know, I guess we just have to like go back to work. Like those deals didn't happen. So then, you know, in the new year, early in January, we went out and someone had told me about the idea of doing a secondary round and suggested, you know, maybe you go to, you know, someone in private equity or, you know, figure out a way to take some money off the table so you can keep building the business and not have to worry about selling it. So we went out and got a couple of term sheets to do a deal that looked like that. And right around that same time, IAC reached out to us and said, you know, they were starting a new programming division and wanted to buy the business. So that all kind of, you know, came together pretty quickly. And I think at the time I was thinking of, you know, because we were really having a fun, you know, it was like, it's still probably the most fun thing.
I bet it was a blast.
And so the idea of selling the business, you know, we really thought that there was a lot of runway left and we wanted to continue working on it. You know, again, we were super young and we were having a good time. So the idea of selling 51% was appealing because in my head, you know, we still had a lot of upside. We figured, you know, if it's a home run and we can, you know, we had a put call arrangement so that we could, you know, force them to buy the remaining 49% at certain points down the road. So it felt like we were pretty well protected in the case of, you know, a big upside. And we were mitigating our downside because we're taking a lot of money, you know, more money than I thought I would ever maybe make in my life, you know, off the table, you know, at 25. So that it all made a lot of sense. Now, the way that it actually played out, you know, ended up being a bit different than that. And I think, you know, one mistake that I think a lot of people make and advice I give just in any deal really, but especially something like this, is I think people tend to focus on the worst case scenario and the best case scenario. Obviously if it's, you know, the worst case scenario, the business dies, you know, 3 days after you sell it, like that's fine. Like at least you sold half. If it's like an absolute home run and you build the next Google and you sell the other 49% and you make $1 billion, like that's awesome too. But rarely is it either of those two things. Yeah. It's almost always something in the middle. So I think, you know, That was certainly the case with us. I mean, in hindsight, we sold a niche content business to a big public company 2 years after Facebook and YouTube were started, right? So like the world was changing and we were inevitably going to get swallowed up.
Right place, right time. Because I mean, I remember every media company was trying to figure out what does their online presence look like, right? They needed to check that box and people are actively looking. And unfortunately, right, like a lot of sellers, you get tunnel vision, right? You're focused, okay, so more money than I've ever made in my life. And like you said, here's what the worst case, here's what the best case looks like. But 9 times out of 10, status quo is what happens, right? So what does status quo look like? And you know, you were almost, if you really think about it, right? If you think about like the Dig at the time and the Reddits, right? You were kind of that community, right? There's content that people are viewing and commenting on and sharing. And, you know, if you had the ability to kind of make it your own, who knows where it would have gone, right? In the long term. And so, but again, that's the risk of selling. And, you know, everybody wants to go get that secondary round, get liquidity off the table. And, you know, it comes with, I guess, the territory.
And you also, I mean, you know, Barry Diller has a reputation of being a challenging person to work for. And, you know, for someone like me who, you know, I wasn't like a Wharton MBA, you know, worked in finance for 5 years, whatever, like, you know, I was a pretty scrappy entrepreneur who was used to doing things the way that I knew how to do them. And all of a sudden now I'm reporting to this like iconic multi-billionaire who's like really, you know, can be difficult and likes to yell. And like, it's, you know, it was very intimidating. And that was, you know, I didn't enjoy that. I'm not, you know, there are some people who really thrive in that environment. I did not. So I think, you know, you're now like running this business, which, you know, ultimately whenever there's a really big decision, it's not your decision. You learn that pretty quickly. And then, you know, you have half of your net worth tied up in a business that you don't control and you're kind of, you know, tied to it. So, so that, you know, the first couple months or first year or so after the deal was great. And then the wheels started to fall off a little bit year two and year, by year five, you know, by the time I left, I was like very ready to not do that anymore.
No, I mean, I've heard that from many people time and time again, right? Because whenever you go into it, the people that are there are a lot of times very different 3 years later. So the people that were supporting you or supporting the vision saw where it can go, you know, they moved up, they moved out, they went elsewhere. And now you have a different person who maybe doesn't have the same vision of where to take that company from kind of from a corporate leadership perspective.
Yeah. And I would imagine you're going from being a full-fledged entrepreneur, you know, whiteboarding, doing whatever you guys are doing. And now you have a control that kind of squeezes a lot of that creativity. I at least would imagine that's probably how you felt.
For sure. There was that. And there was also, you know, the thing that I think about the most during those days is, you know, you go into these board meetings and you're presenting, you know, your plan and the things you're working on. And across the table from me are, you know, guys, you know, at least twice my age, if not more so, you know, smarter, more experienced, you know, all the things, but they don't understand my business as well as I do, or I don't think that they do. I don't think that they did. But that was sort of, you know, beside the point. You know, you walk in and all of a sudden you have these very intimidating guys poking holes in everything that you're saying. And, you know, you would walk out of those meetings having signed up for a site redesign or some shift in strategy that you really didn't believe in, but you weren't able to argue it, or, you know, you couldn't be articulate enough in the moment and you're nervous. And like, you know, there was one time I was getting yelled at and like, I felt myself like almost about to cry. You know, I was like it was so emotional. I wasn't equipped for that. I didn't have the reps to, you know, be able to fight back in those circumstances, nor did I have the confidence. And things weren't going as well as we had projected that they would. So the combination of all of those things, you know, makes it very difficult to be successful, I think.
No, I mean, I used to work at Microsoft. And one of the biggest things you learn early on is how to find your voice, right? You're in a room, a lot of smart people, a lot of people that can, you know, chew you out. And it's easy just to kind of be the pushover. And whenever you have to make big business decision impacts, big impactful business decisions, you have to find your voice. And that's one of the biggest things that, you know, in our company, we try to coach people up, like speak up, right? Like don't hesitate to give your opinion, tell the person, hey, no, I don't think that's the right decision. And here's why. And it's okay. And I think that's one of the biggest mistakes most entrepreneurs do, right? Is they'll grow, get something, but then kind of lose their way for a variety of reasons on that.
Yep.
So yeah, so snapshot. So now you were 25, you're there for 5 years. So you had your exit, you're there 5 years. And then what happens at that point? You decide to leave. And then what goes from there? Because I'm sure you took a tremendous amount of learning experience from all of that to then.
For sure.
The benefits are great.
So, you know, if you recall, the three businesses that we sold was College Humor, Busted Tees, and Vimeo. Pretty soon after the acquisition, Barry Diller decided in one of our meetings that he wanted us to shut down the t-shirt business. And at that point, the t-shirt business was making over $1 million a year in profit and really without much of anybody's effort. So he basically was like, Josh, I don't want you to spend a second of your time on this business. Yeah. And if it deteriorates, like, we're going to shut it down. So it was basically like, which is also frustrating, right? When you own 49% of a business that makes $1 million a year and someone tells you they're just going to kill it because they don't want to think about it. Like, that was annoying. I can't remember exactly when, but it started percolating a little bit in the back of my mind that, like, maybe there was a way I could buy that business out of IAC or take it, because I thought it was a really fun business. During the 5 years that I was there, we had to renegotiate our deal a couple of times because we bought a production company that required some capital, and like, there were all these things. And usually when you're negotiating against a company like that, you don't get the better end of the deal, especially when they control your business. So we ended up having to push our put option out a couple more years. And, you know, we did get a nice employment agreement and, you know, some increased compensation, that sort of thing. So I was now sitting in a situation where, you know, they had to pay me for a couple years, regardless of whether I showed up or not, unless, you know, and even if they fired me, they had to pay me too. So, at that point we decided to sort of collectively that we were going to hire a CEO for College Humor, and it wasn't going to be me. And it was just clear that, you know, it didn't really make sense for me to stay there any longer. But, you know, they would have had to continue paying me. And I sort of led them to believe that I was happy to, you know, sit in my office for the next couple of years and not do anything, and just get paid. Or they could give me all of that money that they owe me, and some of the stock grants that I'd had in the form of this business that they didn't want. And everybody was super fair about that transaction, actually. I think because they didn't want it, it was not.
They thought it was a great deal.
Yeah. So that, again, that was 5 years after I'd sold the business. And then I, you know, May 1st, 2011, I put my pencil down. It was my last day at IAC and my first day of the sole owner of the Busted Tees business. So right around then, you know, and at that point in time, I had like a floor to ceiling glass corner office with like a mini fridge with like Coca-Colas or whatever that got like perfectly arranged in like pencils that someone sharpened every night. You know, it was like a pretty fancy setup. And then fast forward like a month and we're now in like a very dingy loft in Flatiron with like a mouse problem. And I couldn't have been happier.
Well, I got to ask, whenever you were in the fancy corporate office, were you wearing a suit or no? That's just the most important.
No, we all dressed pretty casually. You know, you could kind of tell the people who worked at corporate because they all had, you know, sort of business casual, but, you know, we were mostly wearing t-shirts and jeans. But, you know, it never really felt like, once we were in the IAC building, it never really felt like my home. It felt like we were working in like a big company. And I think a lot of people felt the same way. It just, you know, was no longer our space. So when I bought back the t-shirt business, I think there were six people, including myself. So it was a small team. But it was a great team and everybody, you know, got along really well. And we all knew each other.
You're 100% owner? Nice.
Yep. So all of a sudden I own this business, which I was now making more money like on day two as the owner of this new business than I was making from salary from IAC. And I owned a company that was mine.
Day two. So what did the business cost you? You know, obviously it's kind of complicated because you accelerated things, you changed things. Would you say it cost you? And then on top of that, what was it actually making day two?
So I think it was basically three times EBITDA plus the value of the inventory. So that, you know, EBITDA that year was like $650,000 And then there was a couple $100,000 in inventory. So it was about $2.5 million that the business cost, but cash out of pocket was only, you know, I think it was like $250,000 out of pocket, because the rest was just money that they owed to me in one way or another. So that made it a lot easier to swallow versus like having to write a check that big.
So that's your first acquisition. That's pretty fantastic.
Yeah. So it was great. And then I hired somebody to help me run the business who ended up becoming a great partner and helped me build my next business. But you know, all of a sudden it just felt fun again. You know, I lost so much confidence being at IEC, and, you know, after selling a business and then, you know, having it not work as well as you would hope that it would, you start to question your abilities. And, you know, I definitely had periods of, you know, years really where I was like, well, maybe I just had this one, like, you know, one little success or whatever, you know, scale success. And that was it. And I'm not, you know, I'm not actually that good at this. I just got lucky. And it really wasn't until buying back that business and being able to grow it, and then ultimately growing it into something else that was even a much more successful exit than the College Humor business had been. It took that for me to feel confident again and realize, okay, I know how to do this. Like, I'm not an idiot, even though, you know, Barry Diller might think I am.
You know what I love? I love that you literally are the guy that he comes in and tells you, do not run this business, goes. And you're like, you know what? Screw you. I'm going to take this. I'm going to buy it, and I'm going to take it, and I'm going to grow it. And I bet you that was an internal motivation. Would you agree that, like, the day you took it,
if I'm wrong,
like, I'm going to take this and make this great?
There was definitely some of that. I think there was also a bit of, you know, I remember there's a guy who I know a little bit who, right after I stopped working at College Humor and started doing the t-shirt thing, I was at a party and he came up and he was like, I forget how I put it, but it was super condescending. It was basically like, so are you actually going to be able to stay in New York City and raise your family just with this t-shirt business? You know, it was like, you know, you're doing this, like, it's, you know, it's like a lemonade stand. I think that was the impression that I think a lot of people had of it. And College Humor, you know, while it doesn't really exist anymore, back in those days, in terms of, you know, social credibility, we were, you know, we were getting invited to like all of the cool things. We were, you know, constantly having very interesting people reaching out, wanting to meet us. Like, you know, it felt very much in the mix. And that went away almost immediately after I got out of that business. Like, you know, nobody really, and I think it was also an interesting, you know, lesson. There were certain people who I realized, you know, pretty quickly, like, oh, those weren't actually friends. They were just like business contacts, and that were, you know, that wasn't obvious to me. I just thought that I was like good friends with all these people. And then all of a sudden, you know, I'm reaching out and realizing like they don't want to get lunch with me anymore, you know? So I think there was a little bit of like, you know, screw all these guys, yeah. You know?
Forget the naysayers. And so tell us about this lemonade stand, right? What did it, you know, you bought it, what was the revenue, and where'd you get it to?
So the Busted Tees business, we got it to, I think it was like, it was a couple million dollars when I bought it in revenue. And like I said, it was about $600,000 in EBITDA. And then pretty quickly we grew it to $10 million in revenue and just over $1 million in profit. And right about that time realized, okay, this is just not going to grow. Like, there's no more opportunities for paid acquisition. Like, it's just, you know, this is, I think, as big as this business can get, unless it just turns into something else. And that was when I had the idea for Tee Public, which was, you know, basically eliminating a lot of the hurdles that the Busted Tees business had. And, you know, for example, we would release 16 t-shirts every week at our peak for the Busted Tees business. And some of them would sell really well and some of them wouldn't sell very well. And there's a fixed cost to releasing those. You have to design them, you have to come up with the ideas. And we were taking inventory, so there was an inventory cost. Some of them wouldn't sell, you're sitting on excess inventory. So the idea for Tee Public was really to open it up and to create, you know, more of an open marketplace so that we could attract designers and allow them to contribute and get a portion of the revenue and print everything on demand as opposed to taking inventory. And on-demand printing technology had just gotten to a point where that was a viable business. You know, that was, I guess, 2013. And you know, we built that business and put everything we had into it. And then after the first couple months, it just was not growing at all. So I think we launched it in like March, and by November, despite all of our efforts, no growth, just kind of depressing and not really, not really doing much. I remember coming home and telling my wife, like, I think, you know, and at this point I'd invested several hundred thousand dollars of my own money into building it. And I remember telling my wife, I think we're going to have to shut it down. I just don't think it's working. And then the holiday season happened. And in that business, the holidays were always a huge lift in terms of revenue and conversion. And we had a pretty good lift for the holiday season. And then we made some tweaks to the model and you know, how we were compensating artists and, you know, just some little things that all of a sudden, you know, by January, usually after December, there's a huge drop off for January, but for the business that year, it actually grew into January. And then it started growing 50% month over month. So I think the first year of TeePublic, we did maybe $300,000 in revenue. And then the second year we did 5 million.
Wow.
And then it just, you know, crazy kept going from there. So it was, and at that point it was like, all right, well, this is the business that we need to focus on. And the Busted Tees business just became, you know, an afterthought. And frankly, like, you know, my idea, you know, I wasn't aspiring to just have this Busted Tees business when I bought it back. I was really thinking of it as, you know, a starting point and hoping that I would find my way towards a better business, which is exactly what happened, but it wasn't clear what that was going to be. And that was, you know, I think that's sort of like, at least for me as an entrepreneur, it's always sort of happened that way where you kind of have to just like, you know, I think of that like scene in Indiana Jones where he's got to like walk across the like, you know, huge, cave or whatever. And like, you can't see where it's, you know, you just have to like believe that your foot's going to land in front of you, but you have to kind of take the step, not knowing where you're going to actually step. And I think that was the case with that business for sure.
You just got to cross the chasm, right? That's the phrase. Yep. And so it's, you know, and it's funny how it works like that, right? Because you don't, in hindsight, some of these things are so obvious, right? But living in the, you have to like live and breathe the moment because it's almost obvious TeePublic in hindsight, right? Like, well, of course that makes sense, right? Like, why not leverage, you know, the ecosystem and let people do their own thing? But then it's, you know, at the time, if you really put yourself into the shoes, you had to have been doing Busted Tees to be able to evolve and understand the gaps there and the issues there. And not only that, you had to have technology catch up. Cause I remember buying, you know, off of TeePublic. And at the time I'm like, man, how can they just print anything? Right. Like the technology had to catch up. The whole thing had to tie together and, you know, lo and behold, you have a nice, healthy business.
Yeah. And I think, you know, every business that I've started really was, you know, College Humor was the first sort of original idea that I had in a vacuum where I was like, all right, we need to start something, like, let's do this. Everything else, you know, the t-shirt business was born out of that. You know, Vimeo was ultimately born out of that. You know, the TeePublic business was built, born out of another t-shirt business. You know, a lot of these things were like, I wouldn't have been able to come up with those ideas were I not already working hard on the previous one. And that was, as we talk about the next deal, you know, when I sold the TeePublic business, that was really the first time where I was totally putting my pencil down and had nothing really happening.
What ultimately happened to Vimeo?
So Vimeo was a super frustrating story. I guess I'll just tell you what happened. So basically, we sold 51% of Vimeo along with College Humor and Busted Tees. Shortly after our acquisition, we decided we wanted to pitch Barry Diller on Vimeo and investing more money into Vimeo and you know, having a proper go at that business. So that was, you know, I guess what, 2006, 2007. So we went, we asked for $2 million, which he gave to us to go build out a team. So we built out a team of about a dozen people and like really like some of the best engineers and talented people that I've ever seen, you know, building software. We really found some excellent people and built what really is like the, you know, Vimeo that you see today. I mean, obviously the functionality has changed since then, but the design and really the like the nuts and bolts of what made Vimeo was created in that year. So we started to see some growth, and then ultimately part of the issue with the way that our deal was structured was we had a put call that gave us the option to sell our shares at a certain point in the future. And that was going to be based on fair market value. And, you know, we knew that IAC wasn't going to sell Vimeo. So for Vimeo to be valuable to us in terms of our equity, you know, it was tricky, right? It was hard to figure out how that was going to be valued. So the money that we were spending was really our own money, because even though Barry gave it to us, it was just coming off of our balance sheet. So all of the money that College Humor was making was being just sucked up by Vimeo. So it started to become clear that as Vimeo was losing more and more money, that, and College Humor was not growing as much as we had hoped, you know, College Humor we knew had value, and we knew we were going to sell the rest of it for however many millions of dollars, and that was going to go to us. Vimeo was basically, you know, just like a Series A level, you know, high risk startup with no monetization path, really. Like, we'd tried a couple things without success. So we got to a point where, you know, Vimeo was losing a lot of money, and we kind of had a gun to our head to say, like, either you continue financing it yourselves, or, you know, we're going to like take it and put it in a different part of IAC. That was a tricky moment because, you know, on one hand, you know, it was still an exciting business and we were passionate about it, but it was losing so much money. And there was a very easy path to imagine where it would lose so much money that it would just wipe out everything that we had in equity value for the business. So as a result, we ultimately gave up our equity in exchange for not having to finance the losses, and had, you know, argued at the time to retain some amount of equity, but we were not given that equity, which that part still irks me a little bit because I think it would have been fair for us.
Negotiating with a billionaire is kind of tough.
We got a little bit.
Yeah,
more
I mean, when somebody, you know, you know, when you have leverage, you know, you're meant to use it. So I don't fault them for that. I just regret being in a position where I had such little leverage, because also, you know, you're still working for them, and your willingness to like truly go to the mat against people like that in your, you know, in that position is very slim. So, so we lost that battle.
And so, so I was like, next time you want to give away equity, just let me, in case, you know, we'll be happy to kind of, you know, take you up on it. Had YouTube sold to Google at that time or not yet?
Yeah. And I think that's worth mentioning. Like, you know, I sort of assumed that we had lost, right? Like, I didn't see a path for Vimeo to become worth, you know, when it had its IPO, it was worth $8 billion. It's not worth that anymore. But, you know, I never in a million years saw that. When YouTube became YouTube, I, in my head, figured, all right, well, like, that was our shot and we missed it. And, you know, so Vimeo was turning into something else, but it was always, you know, a thorn in my leg. And frankly, like, you know, my just like way of thinking about businesses is not always conducive to a company that is pre-revenue spending as quickly as possible to try and get users with no monetization strategy. I'm much more simple-minded and coin-operated when I think about companies. I like, you know, generating revenue and profits, and, you know, I can wrap my head around that. It's harder for me.
We get approached by a lot of those kind of businesses that have no assets, you know, no revenue. It's the hope of basically growing it enough to be able to sell the thing. And those are risky businesses, right?
So Josh, as we start to kind of get into the wrap up of what's going on here. So what did you sell TeePublic?
TeePublic was acquired for $41 million in 2018.
Exciting. And you were solo owner, or did you share some of the equity?
I never raised any money. We had an equity pool for our employees. But I was the, you know, I put the money up for the business. It was my company.
And so 6 years later, do you feel like the buyers were happy with it?
I know for a fact that they're happy with it, because you can look at their, you know, it's a public company, and the business has grown, I guess, I don't know, four times over from what I sold it for. I don't know exactly what the profitability is, because I don't know that they break that out in their annual report. But the business has grown dramatically, which is, you know, both exciting, but also a little bit annoying.
But you're still happy, like, you sold it at that time, right? In hindsight, you know, it's like, not like the kind of the situation with IAC where you kind of really, the back of your head, like, maybe we shouldn't have, right? In hindsight.
It's a little bit like, it's a great number.
Yeah.
I mean, it's
someone
not like
described it to me as, you know, it's like when you run into your ex-girlfriend or whatever, like you want them to be happy, but you don't necessarily want them to be blissful, you know?
You built that, and that's the beauty behind it. So what now? So, okay, you've got your exit, you got a big exit. And so in 2018, so what then becomes it? What are the new ventures?
What are you up to now?
What's that next phase in Josh's career from 2018 to today?
So I really tried to divest myself from all responsibilities immediately. So I sold the business in November of 2018. And by January 1st, 2019, I was unemployed and really wanted to just, you know, have as much space as possible to try and figure out what the next thing was. And, you know, I made some early stage investments. I, you know, joined a board or two, you know, sort of started just thinking about like what are next steps and exploring different opportunities. I found a business that I wanted to acquire later that year, to the point where I had a fully formed, you know, long form document that was, I thought we were, you know, maybe a week or two away from closing. We'd already done most of our diligence and it was, you know, we're trying to move very quickly. And ultimately the founder decided that he didn't want to sell the business. So I was really disappointed because it was a perfect match for me. It kind of touched on some things that I was excited about personally. And it was the type of business that I knew I could grow really well. And that sort of got me, and it was in the wine space. It was a wine tech business. And I thought it was, you know, and it was a community. There was a lot of really appealing things about it. But when that happened, it occurred to me that, you know, doing something in a space that I was really passionate about, I've been collecting wine for almost not quite 20 years, but a long time. And I thought it would be really fun to do something in wine. Pardon?
And you collect watches, right?
I do, although fewer now than, you know, when I first sold my business, I went a little overboard perhaps, but
you're one of those watch guys. See, this is my watch right here. A Samsung guy, a smartwatch. Right.
So it's kind of interesting, Josh, you go from being a startup guy, right? Being able to take a company, grow. And now you're looking for, you know, already existing businesses generating cash that you can buy and you can grow. Fits very similar with our methodology of what we look for, right? Is businesses that are existing. We don't have to go in, create the concept, create the initial 5 years of grind, but then we can acquire and then we can bring our skill sets and bring in those things to make it better. So is that kind of where your mindset is now in your life, where you're thinking, hey, I don't want to do the startup thing. I really want to take something that's a little more mature and then add your entrepreneur, you know, GS to
value.
Grow it. Yeah. And that value and grow it.
Yeah, ideally. And I think, you know, I have a wine business that I did end up buying a large piece of, and I've enjoyed that a lot. And that was sort of the thinking there was, you know, it's partnering with somebody who really knew wine much better than I did and understood just the wine industry much better than I did. But I understood e-commerce and, you know, building a tech business better than they did. So it felt like a nice complementary relationship, things like that. I mean, I guess, you know, more simply put, it's for me, it's about finding projects that are exciting that I enjoy working on more so than anything else. And also just finding people that I like working with. Like I have no appetite to go work with people who I think are losers or not even losers, but, you know, just not fun to be around.
Painful people. Yeah. I mean, you spend more time with them than usually a spouse, right?
I like to say the no asshole rule, right? You know, I mean, that's got to be good.
Yep. So working with people that aren't fun is a non-starter. I don't, you know, obviously as an entrepreneur and as a business person, you care about the financial success of a venture, but truly it's not the most important thing to me at all. I care a lot more about just enjoying the thing. And I also feel like, you know, if I'm learning and I'm able to, you know, be productive and contribute to something, like that's, you know, I care more about that. And I think about making investments now more in terms of things that will take up time in a productive way for me that I can add value to versus, you know, I stopped angel investing almost entirely somewhat recently because, you know, that writing small checks into startups and then getting a, you know, an update once a year or whatever, that's not very much fun. I would much rather write a larger check into something, have a real seat at the table, and potentially get, you know, additional upside because of my involvement.
Or get your hands dirty.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, I really enjoy working, and the most depressed I've been as an adult were, you know, shortly after selling both of my companies. So I think it's sort of counterintuitive, and people, it's also the type of problem where, you know, few people will give you sympathy for that. but you know, the truth is, you know, being rich and bored is not great.
Not a good recipe. That's where getting people at a similar caliber around, that's the power of a, like a mastermind group, right? Talking to people that have been there and done that. I mean, we were nominated for Entrepreneur of the Year, and the most impressive thing was the people in the room that have had the same challenges, right? From, you know, from the lawsuits or bankruptcies to, you know, hey, I sold a business and I don't even know what to do with myself, right? How do I keep myself busy? I mean, it's, you know, people, as much as there's no sympathy for it, it's real things that people got to get out there and find someone to kind of relate to.
For sure. And it's also very difficult if you're in a situation like I'm in, you know, you can either, I've had offers to go take CEO jobs. I don't want to take a CEO job. That's a very different, you know, I think a lot of people who are maybe not, you know, super experienced as business people don't necessarily understand the difference between being the CEO of a company you started and the CEO of a company that someone else owns. It's obviously a very different job. You know, so I could go take a CEO job. Don't want to do that. I can take board seats. That's good for like one day a quarter. So that doesn't really, you know, do too much to make you feel satisfied day to day. Or, you know, like, so it's often like, you know, two extremes, and it's hard to find things that are in the middle. And I've been able to piece together a couple, you know, really interesting consulting projects, some businesses that I have an ownership stake in that I'm, you know, involved with day to day. But those are, you know, they're hard to find. And, you know, for it to feel the way that running a company that you're all in on and focused, you know, 100% of your time on, it's really hard to compete with that and to piece it together with a lot of these other small things. And it takes years to do that. At least it's taken me that.
Absolutely. You know, those are first world problems, but they are problems indeed to have. And so
Josh, amazing story.
No, I loved it.
Love your story. We hope to get to know you more. You know, real quick, just what, the listeners that are listening, right? You've had a pretty amazing track record. You may look back and go, wow, you know, a lot of jumps and hurdles and all that. But for the new entrepreneur or the person that's, you know, in corporate America, they're wanting to make that leap of faith into entrepreneurship, maybe buy their own company. You know, what's your words of wisdom for?
I mean, I always think about these things as just like risk mitigation. Like, I think the idea of like just jumping all into something is daunting, but I think most things you can take a really small bite out of it and chase it down and, you know, pretend that you're starting tomorrow, right? Even if you didn't quit your job yet, just start doing the thing. Like, you know, think about like, you know, as if you were working on it full time, like what are the things you would do? And I've found in my experience, oftentimes within 3 months of doing that, you discover A, this is harder than I thought it was going to be. Or B, this is like an even bigger opportunity than I realize. And, you know, I think every idea when you're just like sitting with your buddies, having beers or whatever can sound really great. And then it's not until you really start to do it that you understand the full scope of the challenges and or the full scope of the opportunity as it could be. So I think trying to figure out a way to do something on the side and just like really, you know, just tease it out a bit and understand what the work is actually going to look like, I think is really smart. And I think sometimes people just, you know, get excited and maybe jump in a little prematurely.
100% agree. I mean, too many people think it's about all or nothing versus, you know, it's about taking risks, but taking strategic risk, right? And understanding pieces to kind of get you further along in the process.
All right. So Now it's time for our rocket round. And this is where we're going to ask the guest of three questions. Right. So first question, what do you do in your free time?
In my free time, I have two daughters that are 9 and 11. So I'm mostly with them. I cook dinner at home just about every night. So I really enjoy cooking. I'm in the wine business. I really enjoy wine. So I spend a lot of time writing about wine, thinking about it. And I play the piano. So those
are multiple things. Since I have two daughters too, I have to ask you, have you mastered the braids yet?
I have not. My wife is the braider in the house.
Yeah, I got them figured out. So, I'll teach you the tricks one day. Next question. What's been just kind of your most memorable moment in your business journey?
I don't know. I mean, I think there's so many of them. I think there was a moment when we were, within a 1 month period, we got flown to, the VMAs to sit in the owner's box with all the MTV executives. Then, I'm on Richard Branson's island with him and, a bunch of other people that are amazing for a week. And then I'm at, the Allen & Company ranch, that all happened within a month. And then I've never been invited to any of those things since. Right. So it was just this moment of when you're young and you're sort of on this upward trajectory, and the attention that you're getting is a bit infectious. It's crazy. Right. So I think that feeling was pretty wild. And also, an interesting lesson in it's these things come in waves, and what's popular and what's getting a lot of attention one day is not necessarily going to the next.
Awesome.
All right. Last question is, so what's your favorite, resource or tool that you like to use in business or just in your own personal education? What do you enjoy?
I mean, I like to read a lot of nonfiction, I've sort of gotten a little sick of business books, but I do enjoy reading biographies of people who have done impressive things. But as far as specific tool, I mean, it's mostly, reading it on my Kindle, but I don't have any.
Reading's a fair answer. Have you read the new Elon biography yet?
I have not.
It's sitting on my desk and I have not opened a page yet, but one day I'm going to start that one up. Awesome. Josh, it's been amazing. I mean, definitely really enjoyed the conversation. Last question for those that are interested. I mean, if someone wants to get a hold of you, how can they get a hold of you?
I'm Josh Abramson on Twitter, I guess.
There you go. Perfect. Josh, thank you very much for being on the show. It's been a pleasure. Wealth of knowledge. And you are kind of the canonical example of a serial entrepreneur.
Awesome. Thanks, guys. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for spending time with us.
All right. Talk to you soon.
Thank you for listening to the M&A Launchpad podcast. If you've enjoyed today's podcast and would like to support us, please leave us a rating and a review after you listen. If you're looking for guidance on your next business acquisition or sale, capital to support your next business transaction, or to invest in a private equity opportunity, visit equitylaunchpad.com to learn more and to connect with our team. If you know of an individual who would be a great guest for the show, head over to equitylaunchpad.com/nominate, where you'll have the chance to refer yourself or someone else to be a guest on our show. I'm Casey Minshew, and I look forward to talking with you next week.